Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Mining uranium in Virginia. Will lifting the current ban be an economic windfall or a potential danger to the environment? I'm A. Lily Lee. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Virginia Conversations. The uranium deposit deep underneath Southside Virginia's Pennsylvania County is one of the largest in the world, and a company named Virginia Uranium wants to mine it. Getting to it will take many battles, the biggest of which is Virginia's current ban on uranium mining. But there are also battles unfolding on other fronts. The debate over the proposed project's impact on jobs and the economy, and on the environment near and far. Reporter Fred Eccles visited Pennsylvania County to get a gauge on the feelings of the people living near the uranium motherlode.
Rural Pennsylvania County is probably pretty close to what people conjure up when they imagine Virginia. Farms, rolling hills, and small towns filled with historic homes. But there's a potential major change on the horizon for Pennsylvania, change that some people would welcome and others dread. And it's causing some divisions.
I'm not one of the most popular people right now.
Cynthia Blunt, who lives in Gretna, is hoping the General Assembly will lift a 30-year moratorium and allow uranium mining in Pennsylvania County.
There are people in my family who disagree. There are people in my church. Yeah, I'm kind of taking a little heat.
Blunt says she's done her research on uranium, and she's convinced it's a great economic opportunity for Pennsylvania County and that it can be done safely. Her challenge for opponents is simple and direct.
If you have a better option for the future of this community, the economic future of a survival, albeit of this community, I'd like to hear it.
Oh, no, it's absolutely ridiculous. It would destroy the area.
Eloise Neenan of Chatham says she got involved in this fight back in the 70s when uranium mining companies made their first attempts to set up shop in Virginia. What she's learned has led her to a different conclusion from the one Cynthia Blunt has reached.
And we'd lose the food industry. We'd lose far more jobs than you could gain.
And she expects people to move away from the county if the mine opens. She says many have told her that directly. As for assurances that the mine can be run without damage to the environment,
I've been out west, and I've seen what the problems are there, and they'd be much worse because of our shallow water table and our net precipitation climate.
Not far from Neenan's house, Ron Brown runs the Chattamooka Cafe on Main Street in Chatham. He's also learned a lot about uranium, but in a different way.
Having worked at a facility in Massachusetts where we actually produced radioactive materials using 7 cyclotrons, in a residential area in Billerica, Massachusetts. So I know it's not impossible to actually do something with radioactivity where it can actually be done safely.
Brown says that confidence that it can be done safely is what allows him to support the mine, and he thinks the economic projections are right on target.
It could provide up to 300 or 350 jobs paying in excess of $60,000 a year. I see it as increasing home values, requiring additional housing and so forth.
But while Ron Brown sees a boost for property values, George Stanhope disagrees. Stanhope says he'd like to sell his hay farm near the proposed mine site so he can move to Florida.
We put our farm on the market a couple years ago. It was on for 2 years. The agent in Danville said every time he would mention uranium, people were not interested in going up to look at it.
Stanhope says if he stays, he won't be able to grow hay for much longer. He thinks it's not possible to keep it from becoming contaminated by the mine. So he's pinning his hopes on the General Assembly's voting to keep the moratorium in place. He says the presence of uranium and the prospect of mines in wealthier, more influential parts of the state is a reason for optimism.
I cannot predict it will, but I think that we're gaining more strength that way all the time because of the areas up in Northern Virginia becoming more aware of this.
And speaking of the General Assembly, lawmakers are now waiting for the results of another study before they decide what to do about uranium mining. For Virginia Conversations, I'm Fred Eccles in Pennsylvania County.
Our guests today are Patrick Wales, Project Manager and Chief Spokesman for Virginia Uranium, and Andrew Lester, Executive Director of the Roanoke River Basin Association, an organization opposing the mining project. Welcome to you both. You know, before we launch into this discussion, I think it's important to have a little Nuclear Energy 101 class. A lot of people don't readily understand the connection between nuclear power that fuels so much of our energy and uranium. So here we go. Nuclear power plants do not burn any fuel. Instead, they use uranium fuel, consisting of solid ceramic pellets, to produce electricity through a process called fission. So there you go. You've got the little lesson out of the way. And I'd like to start with you, Patrick. The Alliance for Progress in Southern Virginia did a poll surveying the citizens in the area, and the numbers really leaned more toward, no, we don't want uranium mining. 53% said no. 29% said yes. Why do you think these numbers are occurring, and why do you think there is this feeling about the project?
Well, I think that there's two things. If you look at the poll, they actually asked the question again at the end of the poll, you know, specifically to the issue that will be before the Virginia General Assembly, and that is, should the moratorium on uranium mining be lifted? And when they asked that question, 40% of the respondents said yes, indeed the moratorium should be lifted and regulations should be put in place. So the percentages were much more evenly divided when the question was specifically asked about lifting the moratorium. And moreover, I think that you can look at some other information on public opinion in the area. Delegate Danny Marshall recently did a constituent survey a few months ago, and 55% of his constituents that responded said that they support lifting the moratorium. So I think what all that tells us is that it is a divided issue, and that's all the more important reason to follow the facts and to follow the science and to make good public policy decisions based on those things.
Andrew, I'll do the same with you. Ms. Blunt in our story talks about the economic benefit that would come to the region. That's a very valid point. The jobs that would be created, the boost to the economy. Doesn't that in a way outweigh the potential for risk given that uranium mining is happening all over the world anyway?
Well, first of all, the jobs promised by Virginia Uranium are like 350 jobs. We expect probably much more numbers of that to be basically run away, because there's so many companies in the region that would be affected by uranium mining operation. We have excellent private schools there, Chatham Hall, Hargrave, Carlsbrook, that people send from all over the world there. That's going to be a very, very tough hurdle for a school to overcome, that type of image. We have Nestle Foods there. We have Abbott Laboratories that makes baby food there. We have dairy farmers there, all of whom would be affected by a mining situation like this.
May, if I might just add one thing, and sure. That is that might be Andrew's opinion, but the state of Virginia has really looked at this in depth. They've commissioned several studies to investigate this. One being a socioeconomic study completed by Chimura Economics, a very well-respected economics firm in the Commonwealth. And they have addressed all these things that Andrew has just mentioned, and have pointed to the fact that, by and large, none of those things would be affected. And they looked at case studies from around the world where uranium mining has coexisted very successfully with things like agriculture, with things like education, and institutions of higher learning. So, you know, I think that many of the things that Andrew and his organization often talk about have been addressed independently by the Commonwealth.
Well, this is Andrew again. And basically, if you just use common sense about this situation, if you're going to send your child to a school, you're in Belgium, and you're going to send your child to a private school, and you know the uranium mine is just a couple of miles up the road, are you going to do that? Heck no. It's a matter of common sense as much as anything. The studies that Patrick talked about basically said, look, they can possibly be overcome, but it would take a lot of PR to do it. And here's what it comes down to. If you've got to explain to people why it's not a big deal, you've already defeated. And I got one other comment, too, about the poll that Patrick talked about. When he said 40% said, yes, so let's lift the moratorium, that means 60% said don't lift the moratorium.
No, that does not, Andrew. Look at the results. You can't continue in this discussion and in this debate flying by the seat of your pants and making things up as you go along.
But the numbers do speak for themselves.
The numbers do speak for themselves, and the specific numbers were 40-49. So that is a much closer division, as opposed to the numbers that the other organization points to the very first question. And I think that, you know, this is just highlights further, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the rhetoric that is discussed in this debate. I mean, it is obviously a very interesting issue and one that gets people very passionate. But sound public policy decisions need to be based on facts and on science and on many of the things that Andrew has referenced related to stigma and other things like that. You know, the Commonwealth of Virginia has dealt with this, has looked at this independently, and has concluded that there would be no such effects.
Okay, we have a call from Ron in Roanoke. Go ahead with your comment or question.
Well, good morning, I'm Ron, and I appreciate you taking my call. I don't have a question. I'd just like to voice my opinion about this. Look, I'm an older person, and I point back to the things that our country, the United States, has done over the lifetime of our country. There's so many things that we've overcome and been able to overcome. I was fortunate enough to watch President Kennedy make the speech about putting a man on the moon, and some years later we were able to accomplish that fact. And we overcome so many problems to do that thing.
So you're in favor of uranium mining?
Yes, I am. And uranium mining, we need uranium for many, many things, not just power, but for medicine and for so many other things that we need that we probably don't even realize what we need. And we certainly can take care of any problem that would arise out of possibly groundwater, but that's something that we could overcome. Also, there is so many things that we as a country can't overcome here. Instead of burying our head in the sands and hollering, oh, we can't do this or we can't do that, and people wanting to take us back to wearing loincloths instead of advancing and making our people, our country, and this world a better place to live in.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your comment, Ron. We thank you for that. And I think that's a good one for you to take, Andrew. It's happening. It's progress is occurring. Why are we focusing on this particular region with such vitriol?
Well, first of all, the Roanoke River Basin Association doesn't deal with the issues regarding politics and whatever. Our concern is the protection and enhancement of the river system. And this would be a major threat to the river system. If the caller and the listeners will just look at the record of uranium mining in the United States, look at places like Cotter's Mill and Church Rock, Moab, all those locations, there's no record that we can see where there's been mining that hasn't been major issues involved environmentally as much as anything. And those are in areas that are typically less populated and less damp than it is here. They don't have hurricanes and whatever like we do. And as far as the need for the uranium, we have our supply at this point. We will for the next 20 years. The United States has extended a contract with Russia to buy their nuclear weapons and to transform those weapons into usable fuel here. So we don't. And on top of that, of course, the demand for uranium is dropping around the world because of the Fukushima. Companies are transferring over to other sources of energy.
What are those sources?
Solar and natural gas, primarily. For instance, the CEO of GE just recently announced in Financial Times that the future was not in nuclear energy. It was going to be in solar and in natural gas.
Okay, Patrick, go ahead and take Andrew's
stand. So, you know, I'm not even exactly sure which one of those to start with.
Start with the alternatives. Well, because Andrew is saying that there are other ways of getting our energy.
Well, here's a fact that there are three primary sources of baseload electricity generation. That is coal, that is natural gas, and that is nuclear power. The United States currently uses about 20% or gets about 20% of its electricity from nuclear power, and over 90% of that uranium is imported from other countries. So people in other countries are employed in the uranium industry. We're taking American dollars and sending them overseas when we could be developing jobs and resources here. And specifically to the issue on the Russian supply, we currently get about 19% of our supply from Russian. And Andrew is partially correct that does come from depleted nuclear weapons. It's been a phenomenally successful program that's taken missiles that were pointed at U.S. cities and now power U.S. cities. But it's just not true that program is extended forever. And, in fact, I have information here from USEC, is the company that does this on behalf of the U.S. government, announcing this July that the program is 90% complete and that it will end in 2013. And
okay.
So
Andrew makes a point, too, about problems or trouble elsewhere. Do you want to address that?
Well, I think that the uranium industry is not necessarily any different than a lot of industries. When you look at the way that it operated in the 1940s and the 1950s, and many of those facilities that Andrew referenced, began operating in the 50s and the 60s. But you look at current modern practices in the uranium industry, and one of the best places to look is our neighbors to the north in Canada. They've been very successfully mining uranium for the last 30, 40 years. And you look at the health and safety record of their workers, of the environment around those facilities, and don't listen to the industry, Patrick Wales from the uranium industry. Listen to the Canadian regulator. The Canadian regulator has this to say, that studies demonstrate that present-day uranium workers and the public living near a uranium mine and mill are as healthy as the general Canadian population. And just one more comparison is that current underground uranium miners in Canada are exposed to the same level of radon gas on the job as the average Virginian is in their home. So I think that those are acceptable risks and risks that we should be able to put in lessons learned on how to deal with those risks are things that we should be able to incorporate into the regulatory structure in the Commonwealth.
Andrew, I'd like to give you about 60 seconds to respond to that safety read because I have seen contrary materials in Niger and other places as well. So maybe you can give us that before we go to break.
Well, there are indications that the miners will not be that safe. By golly, think about it. If you're going to work in a uranium mine, you're going to have effects from that type of radioactivity. In addition, the mines in Canada now are not even allowed outside the Arctic Circle because of they don't want them close to the population centers.
Okay. We're going to take a break.
Let's see some proof of that. That'd be great, Andrew.
We'll
Thank
be
you.
Back. You are listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today, our guests are Patrick Wales, chief spokesman for Virginia Uranium, and Andrew Lester, executive director of the Roanoke River Basin Association. Next week, a special Where Are They Now edition of Virginia Conversations as we catch up with John Warner, Jim Gilmore, Chuck Robb, and Oliver North. Stay with us. We'll be back with more Virginia Conversations in just a minute. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We want to welcome our new listeners in the Fredericksburg area hearing us on WQIQ 88.3 FM. Welcome to all of you in Spotsylvania County. Today we're looking at both sides of uranium mining in Virginia with Patrick Wales, chief spokesman for Virginia Uranium, and Andrew Lester, executive director of the Roanoke River Basin Association. We have a call from Robert from Hampton. I understand he's a PhD in nuclear engineering.
Yes, I would really like to have sympathy for Patrick because Mr. Lester has absolutely no facts. It's been very evident over the last 20 minutes that he has no idea what he's talking about, and that's very sad because this is no longer a conversation because the quote-unquote opposition really isn't talking from anywhere. One of the things that made me call in was Mr. Lester says, well, in Belgium, common sense tells you that if you live down the street from a nuclear mine or a uranium mine, that you're not going to send your kids there. Sir, there is no such thing as common sense. Everybody's sense is different from everybody else's. There is no such thing as common sense. If I'm a uranium worker, of course I'm going to send my kid down the street to the school near the uranium mine because that's where I live. And unfortunately, Mr. Patrick is using facts and quotes from very reputable people, and I've heard nothing from you. And that makes me very sad because this is no longer a conversation. You're just being overwhelmed by the facts, and you have no facts to back yourself up. And I'm waiting for facts from you so that I can at least have a way to make an intelligent decision and tell my representative, Rick Morris, what to do.
All right. Can I answer that?
Yes. Andrew.
First of all, when I talked about Belgium, I was mentioning the fact that someone who wanted to send their child to a private school in Virginia, and they lived in Belgium or wherever, or Blacksburg or wherever, they are not likely to want to send their child to a school close to a uranium mine. That's what I was saying. Second thing, regarding nuclear energy and nuclear power, this is not an argument about that. We know of nuclear energy. We know it. We've used it for 35 years. We understand it to some extent. And if a situation that he's talking about, where he works in, it's a very controlled environment. When you're dealing with a uranium mine, it's a very uncontrolled environment because of the environment, the weather, the earthquake situation, storage of the tailings. All those things are very, very variable, and there's no way to control those like you can in a controlled factory, for instance. This is a big difference in what we're talking about.
May, if I might just follow up on that and give you a
sure,
couple
Patrick.
Examples of some specifically addressing the institutions and higher learning. One of the best examples to look at is 45 minutes up the road from our site in Chatham, and that's Lynchburg, Virginia. There are over 5,000 people directly employed in the nuclear industry handling nuclear fuel in Lynchburg every day. They've been doing it very successfully for the last 35, 40 years. And Lynchburg may be one of the locations that has more universities and schools per capita than any other place in the Commonwealth of Virginia. You have Lynchburg College, you have Liberty University, you have Sweetbriar right there on the outskirts, you have Virginia Episcopal School, you have Randolph College. So, you know, those schools have grown up, especially Liberty, which is one of the great American success stories in higher education, in the shadow of the nuclear industry. So we don't have to look all over the world, and there are many more examples. There's a fuel fabrication facility down in Columbia, South Carolina. Columbia, South Carolina is home to the University of South Carolina. And on the regulation, the same entity, the federal agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that regulates nuclear reactors, and Andrew, it sounded like, agreed that they operate very safely, that same federal agency would regulate two-thirds of our proposed operations. So they would regulate the milling, and they would regulate the tailings. What goes on in the mill is a very controlled operation. What goes on in the tailings process is a very controlled operation. And furthermore, what goes on in the mining is very controlled as well. And we have a very good track record of mining various things in the Commonwealth very, very successfully. You know, I think that when you look at all these things, there are a lot of similarities, especially that we have two-thirds of the same regulator as our counterparts in the nuclear industry.
Yeah, but the answer to that is the fact that you still are in an open mine situation with material being moved back and forth, with dust, with runoff, potential problems from hurricanes, tornadoes. This is not a controlled factory environment. It's not enclosed. It's not encased in a factory situation. The mining and the tailings will be exposed during the process. And then after the storage, they're prone to environmental issues. So this is completely different from a fabrication operation or a refining operation where there's a controlled factory.
Well, I'm glad that
I know that Lynchburg was mentioned, and we actually have a call. Dan from Lynchburg, go ahead.
I'm from Lynchburg, and I work in the nuclear industry for Areva. I was going to point
talk
out.
Talk about
that
Areva.
One of the
Areva has shown up in the. Let's talk about Areva for a second for listeners who don't know what Areva is. It's taking a lot of flack as a uranium mining company for alleged safety violations. Go ahead.
Well, I'm looking at this and looking at uranium mining, and I wanted to look at it from a different perspective in terms of reviewing it in terms of coal mining. You talk about weather, and you can look at coal mining and ash ponds, and there seems to be no control about ash ponds collapsing and contaminating just with toxic sludge all over the certain areas. That happens all the time. Coal mining, lung miners get injured that way more so than any uranium mining operation. Coal releases more radioactivity than uranium mining. So we can look at that in lots of different aspects. You take a look at, you mentioned recycling of nuclear weapons, and that's a totally different aspect and a different kind of, I'll say, uranium for the best, or maybe plutonium, and that's not the same type of fuel. So I think attacking uranium mining because we have weather, well, there's weather all over the world. Attacking it because we have radiation potential is saying, well, you know, you fly across the country and you get more radiation than you would as working as a miner. Radon is a issue, but that's taken care of with ventilation. Church Rock was mentioned in May 2007. The EPA started cleaning that up. We still have New Mexico uranium mining going on and doing a good job. General Atomics is still working the Mount Taylor mine with in-situ leaching. So I'm kind of at a loss to say that we should not do uranium mining in Virginia when it's a source of jobs and revenue and a natural resource.
Okay, thank you so much for your call. I want to go to another caller, this one from Richmond. Her name is Erica, and she's concerned about tailings. And so we can launch into the discussion about uranium tailings. I just want to define what those are. They're a waste byproduct of uranium mining. And one of the questions at hand is whether tailings from the Coles Hill mining operation would then leach down into Lake Gaston and then affect folks in the Hampton Roads area, in other areas. So let's take Erica's call, and then Patrick and Andrew, we can start talking about tailings. Erica, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was actually listening to the commission that came out with the report, and they basically said that we'd have to watch over the radioactive tailings for 1,000 years. I mean, I do not think this is part of the legacy I want to leave my children and grandchildren with. And I don't want Virginia to become another Superfund site where all the other past areas in other parts of the country and the world are dealing with. I mean, we need to move towards safer, cleaner energy. And frankly, with our weather, it's going to be impossible. I just don't think it's a good idea.
Okay, Patrick, that's yours. Thank you, Erica.
Yeah, well, first of all, just on the one of those comments there, the nuclear industry is the safest and the cleanest form of producing baseload electricity, and that really is without question. On the tailings issue, though, this is really, really important. Virginia Beach, the city of Virginia Beach, has looked at this. They've done some models on, you know, what would happen in the event that a release occurred. Andrew and his organization are very concerned about this because they represent the Roanoke River. And unfortunately, the assumptions that went into all of those models assumed that tailings would be placed in above-grade facilities. So basically, a big dam would be built and the tailings would be held behind it, the theory being that in a catastrophic storm event, tailings would be released if the dam failed. The problem is that that is not the prime option for tailings disposal. That is not what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission wants to see. So, moreover, we have the National Academy of Sciences report that recently came out on this, commissioned by the Commonwealth of Virginia, pointed to full below-grade disposal of mill tailings is an option that's been developed in the industry specifically to eliminate concerns over the release of tailings. the folks in Virginia Beach that have raised concerns. The public utilities director has said that they agree. If you're able to put these tailings below grade, it significantly reduces or eliminates the concerns that they have. And finally, that's what our company has done. We have put in writing to the city of Virginia Beach and to the mayor down there that we are committed to using what the National Academy of Sciences has said is the best, using what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission wants to see in their regulations, and committing to what Virginia Beach has said as well, that significantly reduces their concerns by putting the tailings in below-grade structures.
We have another caller. This is Eloise from Chatham. Go ahead, Eloise.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have four facts I'd like to get out. First of all, my own experience in the early 80s, after testifying at a federal hearing in Denver on radioactive waste, I went over to Grand Junction and Union Carbide, who was involved with Marline at the time, took me down to Eurovan, and I had a chance to go in an underground mine and see an open pit mine. I did not go in the mill. I would not do that, but I could see it, and I could see the tailings where they had them out in a pond. I could feel some of the dry ones. They're like fine, very, very fine sand and baby powder mixed together. So I've had some personal experience. It's now a Superfund site, by the way, which our taxpayers pay for. But fact number one, we don't need it. The Department of Energy has said we have enough uranium on hand to last at least 30 years for nuclear power plants and for nuclear submarines. We don't need it. Yes, we have imported downblended uranium from Russia because that builds up the stockpile as such, but we do not need it. And this uranium would likely to be exported. The big market right now happens to be in China. One of the other another fact too that we need to keep straight, this is not the largest deposit of uranium in the U.S. That's been something that Virginia Uranium has pushed and pushed, and it's an absolute lie. There are much larger deposits elsewhere in the U.S., out west, and as far as large deposits, this is minuscule compared to what you have in the Sahara Desert, in Niger. Areva went to Niger, for instance, where the cost to hire a miner is a fraction of what it would be here. So it's not that big a deal. Another fact is the jobs hoax has been pointed out, the jobs that would be lost. And if you've read the papers lately, you see the number of coal miners that have been, hundreds have been laid off in southwestern Virginia and in West Virginia. It takes at least a year for a potential coal miner to get licensed. The coal miners move around, and so miners would come in from there. That wouldn't be a matter of these jobs for people locally. And another fact that you may not be aware of is the Methodist resolutions from the Virginia Annual Conference and the Holston Annual Conference, which cover Southwest Virginia, calling for maintaining the moratorium. Both of these have been passed by those conferences by an overwhelming majority, a very, very strong stand by the United Methodist Church, and there are others that are coming on board with this also.
Okay. Eloise, thank you for your four points. Andrew, I'd like for you to address the first one, which is she's saying we have enough. Is that true?
Absolutely. The cost of uranium is going down. It's like $47 now. It's been going down for quite a while. It's a yo-yo type business. One day it's $70, next day it's $47, and that, of course, leads to boom and bust cycles in the business. That's the issue. Now, I do want to address one other thing regarding tailings. When Patrick said that the NRC is okay with putting it underground, they recommend it in arid areas like out west. They don't necessarily recommend it in an area like we have here where the water levels below grade are very close to the surface. In addition, you've got other problems with tailings underground or any storage of tailings. We're talking about probably 29 million tons of this stuff. That's 14.5 million cars stored on site. You've got to have a lot of land for that. You've got to have you got to protect it from drainage, from leaking through the clay and the liners. We know that landfills leak. We know these will leak. Who's going to maintain them for thousands of years? Who's going to repair them if a problem occurs? And how are you going to protect one while it's open and you're storing material in it before you cap it? That's another issue.
Maybe I'm not able to get my brain around this, but help me with my physics. If the tailings are directed below water level, as Patrick's discussing, doesn't that then keep us free and clear of safety issues?
Well, look at it this way. If you're going to put it in water, if you're going to store it in levels where there are water, basically the water around there and the water underground will be affected, will be polluted.
Patrick?
So again, here we go. We're making it up as we go along. We got Andrew's opinion. Unfortunately, for Andrew, that's not the case. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, he just referenced that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission thinks this or thinks that. No, here's what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission thinks, that they see absolutely no difference in licensing a facility in the arid Southwest versus in Virginia. And they said specifically, the liner that has to be designed to keep material from entering the surrounding environment, that doesn't change whether you're in the desert or in the Piedmont area of Virginia. This is an actual regulator at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying this. And there is a very stringent and strict process that we have to follow. We will be subject to an environmental impact statement. That is the most thorough federal review that any entity can really undertake. It's through the NEPA process. It's a four-year process, start to finish, where every single one of these specific questions on groundwater, on making sure that your emissions and your effluent and all of that meet or beat regulatory standards has to be completed. So this is not a choice that we have. It's a requirement. It's in the federal law, and it's something that Virginia Uranium is committed to doing.
We have callers waiting from Hampton to Pennsylvania County. I hope that you will hold on the line because we're going to take this quick break, and then we'll be back to join the conversation. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We want to welcome our new listeners in the Fredericksburg area hearing us on WQIQ. Thank you so much. And we want to also let you know that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. Our discussion of uranium mining in Virginia will continue in just a minute. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today, the pros and cons of uranium mining. Our guests are Andrew Lester, Executive Director of the Roanoke River Basin Association, and Patrick Wales, Chief Spokesman for Virginia Uranium. We have a call from Halifax. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm from Halifax, and I'm a little bit upset with Mr. Wales for assuming that the people that live downstream just aren't smart enough to figure out that this is going to contaminate our drinking water and our air. Everything that you all come up with, there is scientific evidence that proves, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if you stack radioactive material in the ground or on the ground that has been crushed up into fine powder, that it's not going to get in people's drinking water and that it's not going to get into the air. I take great offense in that you attack Andrew for saying that these are not factual things.
Yeah, one of our callers actually attacked Andrew.
That wasn't supposed to happen either. The contamination is still being detected down there, and we will have irreparable damage from the uranium mine if it is brought to light. I am not worth the risk, neither is my family, and we don't need it. It's been proven that we don't. Just because you say it's going to work doesn't make it so. If you put it in the ground in a crushed up form, it's going to leach out into groundwater.
Okay, thank you so much for your call, Sarah. Patrick?
Sure. Well, I think that if there are these stacks of facts out there, that I'd love to see them. I mean, all I've heard today is a lot of opinion and rhetoric. And I have we have facts, and you know, we're able to demonstrate in locations around the world where you know, over the last 30 years that this industry has been done very, very effectively and has been protective of human health and the environment. But there's something else that I want to throw in here, and that is, you know, I live here too. Every single one of our employees at Virginia Uranium is from Danville, is from Pennsylvania County, is from Chatham, is from Gretna. We've chosen to live in this area that we love and raise our children. So when we come to work every day, we bring the highest professional commitment to ensuring that we build and operate the safest uranium mine and mill in the world. But we also bring a highly personal and moral commitment to that as well. And I guess just picking up on the point about groundwater issues and environmental issues is that we do not receive a license to operate from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and if the state of Virginia was to develop regulations for uranium mining, until we demonstrate how we are going to adequately protect human health and the environment. So the burden is on us. All that our company has been seeking for the last 5 years is for the Commonwealth of Virginia to write the rules for uranium mining. It's very difficult to demonstrate how you're going to do something when the rules of the game have not been written. And
we have a caller from Pennsylvania County, one of your neighbors, Patrick. Karen, go ahead.
Hi, Patrick. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
I think you just said the rules of the game have not been written, and that's true. So, in fact, I guess that means that when both of you talk, that maybe you're not in command of the facts. But I wanted to say an earlier caller was talking about nuclear energy, and the conversation is not about nuclear energy, and it shouldn't be. We can't dispose of the waste from reactors now, much less, talk about doing mining and milling here. Milling has been kind of overlooked in this process. With the milling, that's when we have another kind of issue with the waste. And my understanding is from Mr. Coles Jr. and the state geologist Lassiter, and the recent release of the street names where the 40,000 acres of Pennsylvania County had leases, historic marline leases, that Mr. Coles has stated in presentations, and I believe it might be in the literature that you have, the technical study, that this would be the first of other areas in Virginia that might come under exploration. And state geologist Mr. Lassiter had said yes, if the moratorium is lifted, that there will be additional exploration here. And so if we want to, I'd like to talk about that. And also there's concern because a resolution is coming before the Board of Supervisors here, and they've been unsuccessful, like so many other sites in Virginia and even North Carolina, different municipalities and organizations, resolution saying that they are opposing the lifting of the moratorium because of these studies that have come out and shown the risks. The question I have for Mr. Wells would be, there were 30 or 31 investors, I believe, initially that were local investors. Should we have concern that the reason Pennsylvania cannot pass a resolution is that some of the earlier investors sit on our board of supervisors, or on other areas where there might be some important decision-making going on in the state?
All right. Karen, thank you for your call. Patrick?
Well, I'm not going to justify that question with a response. Miss Mowdy certainly has her opinion, and it is deeply held belief, and there's probably little that I'm going to say that is going to sway that opinion.
So your paths have crossed before, is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, all right. Margaret from Hampton, go ahead with your call.
I want to point out that the length of mining that's going to take place there has been estimated to be 30 years, and then the company will leave, number one. Number two, I'm a little offended by the statement that there have been no facts presented. I believe it's a fact that the radioactive byproducts of uranium have half-lives of thousands of years. And I wonder how the liners are going to last that long, even though they may be underground. I also wonder about radon gas.
Thank you, Margaret. Margaret brings up an interesting point that has been brought up a lot in this discussion, and that is that we're focusing a lot on our lifetime, but that this and what this project means right now, but that there are implications for generations here.
Well, I think that you look at the geology of the area. One of the interesting things that this deposit has remained largely unchanged and in the ground for several million years. And when you're talking about the tailings disposal, it's really important because you're basically putting the material kind of back underground into an excavated lined facility. Now, there's a combination of liners that are often used, both natural clay. Natural clay has been proven to be one of the best liners that anyone's come up with. There certainly are synthetic materials as well. Currently, the laboratory results indicate they have a lifespan of about 200 years. And so that's why we couple these things with redundant safety systems, a multiple series of liners and leak detection systems and groundwater monitoring. And again, the company has to demonstrate that we're able to adequately isolate this material from the environment, as the National Academy of Sciences has said has been done in the industry over the last 30 years.
All right. And Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a couple of comments on that. First of all, we don't have any record of any liner lasting 200 years. And in 200 years is nothing compared to thousands of years. In addition, the tailings are unstable. As he mentioned, they're in the ground now in granite. Once you expose them to air and water, they change into daughter products, which are much worse than even the uranium. I mean, it's a very poisonous products from that. Patrick and his company have done a great job of advertising and trying to convince people the last 4 or 5 years that this is a great operation. But the Roanoke River Basin Association represents 68 or 70 towns, communities, localities up and down the river system from Blacksburg to the Outer Banks. And all of them practically have voted that this is a bad idea. They passed resolutions saying this is a bad idea. The Hampton Roads Planning District Commission, which is 16 cities and towns from the North Carolina line to York County and whatever, they've all voted against this. It's almost unanimous that this is a bad idea. So he can say we don't have the facts, or we just got common sense, or whatever he wants to say. The fact of the matter is everybody has looked at the six studies that were done by the best and brightest in the world, and the six studies came back and said, if you do this, you're taking a big risk. And that's really the bottom line here.
Berkeley from Danville, go ahead with your question or comment.
Well, Patrick just pretty well answered my question. The fact is that the experts stated that the liner is only going to last possibly up to 200 years. Right after they had made the statement that the uranium tailings to last beyond 2,000 years, and he comes up with this statement about how clay is one of the best liners there is, but he can't guarantee that it lasts more than 200 years, and it just, I don't know, what are they going to do if they do have a leak at 200 years from now? Dig it all up and replace the liner?
Well, the specific liner that I was referring to was the synthetic liner, and so we know that natural clay has a very long lifetime, and it has been demonstrated that clay liners have been very successful. So that's why you couple these things. That's why you don't just rely on one type of liner. And then another thing is that the surrounding underlying rock that we're dealing with essentially is a solid granite, so has Mother Nature provided an additional protection? And these are all the types of things that we look at. We don't just rely on engineering protection in the form of synthetic or natural liners. We also look at the topography and the geology and how those can further enhance isolating the material from the environment for a very long time.
We have a call from Roanoke. Frida, you're on the air.
Hello. I was calling to bring up the point that whether or not this would be a good economically investment to mine uranium in Virginia. Germany has shut down several of their nuclear reactors because they have been moving to energy efficiency. And as they've been shutting down the nuclear reactors and going to more alternative energy that's sustainable, they've actually been exporting energy to their neighbors. And if we start following their example, there's not going to be a market for uranium mining if there's not nuclear reactors. So why would we take the economic risk of opening up a radioactive site in Southwest Virginia that the taxpayers are going to be liable for, both in the state and in the nation, for industry that might be on its twilight.
Well, I think, may I address that one on the economics?
Yes.
This is Patrick with Virginia Uranium. It's a little bit of a misnomer that the nuclear industry is waning. And, in fact, the United States, we live in the nuclear capital of the world. We have 104 operating reactors supplying 20% of our nation's electricity. In Virginia, we have four reactors that supply almost 40% of our electricity. We actually get more power from nuclear in Virginia than any other source. A lot of people are surprised to learn that. Currently, the supply-demand dynamics are that there's about 180 million pounds of uranium needed for the 430 reactors around the world. And all the uranium mines in the world are only producing about 150 million pounds. So there's this big gap. So there's already a supply-demand deficit. Furthermore, you know, the United States, as has been referenced several times, it's been said that we don't need this. Well, the United States is the largest consumer of uranium in the world, and 90% of it is imported from other countries. So we absolutely do need it. If we had all of these stockpiles of material, as one caller alluded to, then why aren't we using it? Why do we bring it in from various countries? So the nuclear industry has a really bright future, and certainly there is going to be growth around the world and hopefully growth in the United States.
Andrew, do you have anything to dovetail off that?
Well, first of all, I refer back to what the CEO of GE said, that nuclear energy is not going to be the future, and the prices reflect that. They're $47 a pound. The stock in the UI is at 14 cents a share. These are all indications that the future is not there in nuclear energy. The power plants we have are 35 years old. Nobody wants to build them because it's too expensive. Investors will not invest in nuclear energy for new construction. The federal government has to subsidize it. It's a dinosaur. It's on its way out, no doubt about it.
Julius from Fluvanna County, go ahead with your call or comment.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment that Virginia should really be leading the way with offshore wind power, solar power, and so forth, instead of going backwards to something that's just needs to be phased out worldwide.
Well, I would candidly agree with you on the first part, that Virginia should be a leader in renewable technology. I think that, you know, we have many people talk about an all-of-the-above approach. When it comes down to nuts and bolts, though, unfortunately, a lot of people are only interested in all-of-the-above the ground. In order to continuously produce electricity that keeps our hospitals running 24/7, that keeps you know, our cities and our factories moving and powered, it takes baseload energy. Predictably, last night the sun went down and we lost that energy source. Right now it's a very still day. The wind is not blowing. Where those technologies like wind and solar are possible, they need to absolutely be deployed. But the unfortunate reality that a lot of people don't like to look at is that we need base load electricity. That's the stuff that runs things all the time, and there are really only three sources for that, and that's coal, natural gas, and nuclear power.
My comment on that would be, yes, at this point, nuclear power is a component, but in the future will not be. It's pretty obvious that it's on the downside. And what will happen if we open this this mining operation in 10 years, the price goes to the point where it's not economical to operate. The UI walks away. The taxpayers have to maintain the site and the tailings forever at the taxpayers' cost. Here's an example. There's one location on the East Coast that's been mined, a 10-acre site in Pennsylvania, Canonsburg, Pennsylvania. It costs like $75 million to rehab it, and then it's still a Superfund site, and it's going to be maintained by the taxpayers. And that's a 10-acre site. Patrick's operation here is at least a 3,500-acre site.
Let me follow up on that with Andrew. And Canonsburg was a facility that operated, I think it began as early as 1930. That was before there was such thing as an EPA or a Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and certainly before a thing called financial assurance. Very specifically in the Code of Federal Regulations pertaining to uranium mills and tailings facilities, And the specific code section is 10 CFR Part 40, Appendix A, Criterion 9 and 10. Those two criterion deal specifically with the financial assurance that the company pays. And the company is responsible for putting up, in advance of receiving a license, on an annual basis to make sure that the situation Andrew just described does not occur. So we've changed significantly the way that we regulate. We've changed significantly the way that we operate, where the taxpayers aren't on the hook, and the industry is dynamically different.
Patrick, thank you so much, as well as you, Andrew. That's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our guests, Andrew Lester and Patrick Wales. Gentlemen, this is a topic we will be hearing a lot about in the coming months, I'm sure. And, of course, thanks to you for listening. On the next Virginia Conversations, a little reminiscing with John Warner, Jim Gilmore, Chuck Robb, and Oliver North. That's coming up next Friday morning at 9. For Virginia Conversations, I'm May Lily Lee.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.